thing that they had undertaken to hire a consultant whose name I can remember was Blagan. And this Dr. Blagan from Minnesota, as I recall, Minnesota, was a highly esteemed individual. He was an authority and a recognized person in his own right.
Had he been president of Minnesota?
I'm not sure if he was the president or he had some other capacity. He was a name known and recognized and respected in academic circles, which may or may not mean anything depending upon who you're talking to. So he was engaged by the foundation to study the research potentials in the state university system and whether the state university was getting all the research grants and projects that it could through the system that it had, etc. And that was his function. For whatever reasons, and probably because he was asked to by somebody or somebodies, he ventured into the realm of whether the state university should have campuses located decentralized in the state itself or one huge centralized campus. Now, the state university trustees had already, since the university creation, faced that problem of whether there would be a centralized university and decided there would not be. Because the swiftest, most economical, and effective way of getting education where it was deemed necessary was to provide for it in the decentralized locations that it had already in existence. But anyway, Blagan came out with a report which recommended the creation of this huge centralized university. And then, for reasons that I never was able to understand, the then president of the university, Dr. Carlson, his assistant, and I suppose the Research Foundation people put out his report to the press before the courtesy was given to have the governor of the state of New York see this document, or his people see the document, or the state university trustees, for that matter, have opportunity to look at it. They were reading it in the New York Times before they were reading it themselves. And this incensed the Board of Trustees, but it further incensed the governor. He was really, really distressed.
This was Harold.
Yeah. And he had reason to be, sure, because it was a very discourteous thing to do. And it had the potential of setting back the university pretty badly if it couldn't be explained to them that the university trustees had nothing to do with this document, did not see it, did not authorize it,
nor approve
of it, etc. So, what do you do? So I suggested we ought to write a white paper. Well, you know, if the guy comes up with an idea of what ought to happen, he's the guy who gets the job. So I got the job of writing a white paper, as it were. And I used to laugh about writing white papers because I always had yellow sheets in my typewriter. And I'd turn and laugh about the white papers. But anyway, I wrote this document, which the university trustees adopted at a meeting, restating the university's policies and restating them emphatically in that this had never been an authorized arrangement, et cetera, et cetera, and which cleared the air so far as they were concerned. But it really was the last nail, as it were, in Dr. Carlson's coffin, because the trustees had been less and less satisfied with his performance and some of his associates.
Where did he come
for a period of time?
Where did Carlson come from?
I don't remember offhand. And so that really hit the fan. The trustees had a special meeting, and in the special meeting, Carlson was advised that he better make arrangements to go somewhere else. So he resigned to be effective the following September or something like that. So right away that created a problem of interim management because the trustees did not want to have a disposed president functioning in the period of time before his departure. They wanted to complete, and given the facts and given the situation, the climate that existed, they wanted a complete change.
Right.
So it was at that point, here again, somebody says, what do you do? And I said, well, you don't have an individual sufficiently dominant in your central administration. Let's take what I call the Committee of Deans. And we put on this Committee of Deans the dean for the four-year colleges and the dean for the two-year colleges and the dean, Slocum, who was the dean for some scattered activities as well as being the administration president or vice president. So we named them a Committee of Deans, and then the Committee of Deans can run things, and any two out of three can vote to do et cetera. Well, that was fine, except then I got designated behind the scenes to run the Committee of Deans. That was we were makeshift with an administration at a very, very difficult time period. And we were walking on a lot of eggs, as it were, because we had things that had to be done with it. Various things that had to happen, and we had this problem to contend with. I think in retrospect, it worked out very well. Jack Crary is of the council, Charlie Foster is our treasurer controller, a super kind of a guy, both of them. And we worked with the so-called Committee of Deans to see that everything came out the way it should, academically, legally, public-wise, etc. And this took some doing because, as is normal, the Committee of Deans had its own competitive feelings internally as among groups and as among individuals. So there was a good deal of that, to be involved. But it did get us past a very difficult time, and moving further.
Let's peg the time.
That would have been
57 or 58.
That would have been starting. That would have been starting around December, January of 57, 58, and going through the period until I think it was
appointment
of Tom Hamilton, which was. Which took place in the spring or summer of 59. So it was a period of a year and a half, roughly. And during that time, a lot of these decisions had to be made. And one of the things, for example, and I remember this dramatically, I remember saying to Frank Moore, controller, we've got to move this program at Long Island. The regents have given its approval. The ball's back in our court. You can't say that because we've had leadership difficulties that all of a sudden now nothing's going to happen. We've got to make it happen. And one of the things that we talked about was how quickly could we get a program going at Planning Fields. Carlson said the fall of 1958. This was backed up, backed up before that. He said like the fall of 58. And I remember saying, this was before, again, I had official connection. We've got to get going earlier than this. We have all these problems. Let's get going in fall of 57. Now, this is one of the areas in which the board in Carlson parted company. They were for movement, he was for procrastination. He could do it better if he had more time, etc. And so, I remember to say sometimes that, people sometimes in the academic world had a geologist concept of time. And as a newspaper man, I had a newspaper man's concept of time, which meant that you had a deadline. Your deadline was 11 o'clock tonight, and the story had to be written because the paper was going to go to press at 1 o'clock in the morning, whether you had, and you couldn't have a blank space. Now, if you approach things that way, as it did, I had a great impatience with what happened. And I think some of my impatience was contagious. It sort of caught on with some of the other people and with people that I spoke with in the state government. You cannot continue to do things as usual, because the as usual is not going to get the job done, either in terms of time period or in terms of methodology. So Carlson was opting for 58, and the board was dissatisfied, and they started it at 57. But then we put the heat on to move it, develop it, grow it, etc. Even more so in 1958 when we talked.
Well, it's interesting to watch the evolution of the mission of that particular institution as to what it was supposed to do first initially, and then a modification to a four-year liberal arts institution. I don't know when the engineering was added to it, but it didn't start with engineering, I don't think.
Originally, my recollection is that originally the trustees recommended for Regents' approval that there be this four-year college for teacher education, and that it include primarily designed to educate teachers in the fields of science and mathematics to fill that void that was we spoke of. And then the crowd after that, there was a included in that same plan, that same proposal, was that this college also become a college of science and engineering to fill the gap which was being identified between the production of engineers, for example, in the state schools, and the need for them, as it were. I think that the plan would have been approved with the omission of the second, more larger plan or proposal, if it hadn't been for Sputnik being thrust upward at that in the time period before its approval. The Regents' approval of the plan that was proposed by the trustees in 1956 came, my memory serves me, like, you know, within a month or two or three months after Sputnik. And I think that sort of served to emphasize the need for
engineering as
the engineering as well. Now, so we embarked on this plan it started in the Coa State, the playing field, and even to bring science and engineering students in there in temporary facilities, starting them off, and you know about this, I'm sure.
And I lived there for 3 years.
As you well know. So, you know what, but here again was the impatience of some of us to say, look, I don't care how the academic world does things. This is no longer a situation in which we can sit by and do things the way they've always done. We can't have ruts in our thinking. I used to chuckle to say to people, look, the greatest advantage that I have is that I'm not academic. I have no tradition. I have no roots of any kind. I have no regard for formality. I have no regard for how it's been done or how it ought to be done. The question is, how are we going to do it now? Within the time frame and within the context of the environment, the circumstances where we find ourselves. So we get going in that direction. The question arose is, what are we going to do about a curriculum? And here again, now go back to my days in the General Electric Company. I said to Frank Moore, I got a thought here. I said, I always learned in the General Electric Company that they were unhappy with the way the colleges and the universities produced their graduates for engineering, science, etc. And I said that I propose that I go to the men I know back in the General Electric Company and tell them now's a chance to put your action where your mouth is. Put your action where your mouth is. We need a curriculum for science and engineering in Long Island. You don't like the traditional method of providing for engineers, civil, aeronautical, mechanical, whatever. You tell us what the United States, what you, what industry, what the United States ought to have in this time period ahead. And I said, one thing, I think you should put your best brains to work on it, and two, I think you should do it for free. So the gentleman that I talked to was named Linder. He was the vice president of GE for their engineering. And he said, that's an intriguing idea and a challenging thing. He said, I don't know whether we can do it, because it would mean taking people from responsible positions if you're going to get good brains and putting it together to do something. I spent 2.5 years with a General Electric Company dealing with various kinds of task force. You have a task force for this and for that, and for this and that and the other thing, where you draw people together for the business plan. Strung together for this. Well, they agreed that they would talk about it, and lo and behold, the answer came back, yes, they would do it. Now, I think it's fortunate that we got them to initiate activity in this direction, that they were able to draw in other kinds of people, and that their work could serve to help you fellows with a kind of program that came to pass. It probably got altered. It probably has been altered since, but it basically represented a step out of that lockstep arrangement of engineering graduates.
Civil, electrical, mechanical.
And a movement out of that area, because I had heard GE people say, look, train these people in the science and engineering with other things so that when we get them, we can specialize them if necessary. But in the meantime, they need to know, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, one of the other things that I found lacking in the management in big business was a sense of civic responsibility, a knowledge of government, a knowledge of relationships with people, a knowledge of communications, how to communicate to people, how to tell people what the hell you're talking about. And so I envisioned that there would be, this would be a real advantage if they could have science and engineering students not become so enamored of their particular field that they didn't know anything about anything else.
So they weren't tied to a particular type of hardware which would become obsolete.
Right.
And they had to have the basic science underlying.
Yeah.
So that they could switch.
Yeah.
And evolve. And follow along with the technological evolution. Yeah.
Yeah. And
so this was before Lee came in.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And now at that same time, we also had a problem with Melville, because he had given the State University this land for the development of a very beautiful, small, four-year college, which would fit into the environment of the community, both physically and intellectually, as it were. The one that wouldn't thrust itself openly, or knew where the buildings were compatible with, etc. One where the program was compatible with. I think that he and Mrs. Melville envisioned a lovely ivy-covered liberal arts school with perhaps 500, 600, 700 students. That would be named the Melville College, and it would be a delight for the whole community, and it would be a place where the community people of their type could come and hear chamber music.
That's what's happening, actually.
No, that's what's happening. I know.
As far as the music.
I remember the time I got invited to come down there and attend a musical program. I've forgotten whether it was chamber music, but it was some other classical music by a visiting group, a resident. Maybe they were in residence or something at the time. I've forgotten that specifics, but everybody was amazed that I accepted and that I actually came and participated. But to me, it was part of what I'd been dreaming about, that there would be this institution and that it would have that type of thing, you know. But anyway, we had this problem with it was a public relations problem with Melville's, because somehow or other we had to break the news to them that this was no longer going to be what they had envisioned. And
the need was much greater.
And we had to talk about the patriotism. We had to talk about the patriotic need for there to be an instant Caltech, as it were. And so we did. I don't think that the Melvilles were ever entirely happy with what transpired, but that's the way life sometimes is.
They weren't. And it was compounded by the type of architecture initially used. I think women very often hold an antagonism or are less free to give up loyalties than men are. I think toward the end of his life, Lord Melville realized that he had helped to create something far bigger and far more important than he had an original idea of.
Yeah, yeah,
and
I think so.
I think he was...
I agree with you. He was less concerned with the aesthetics of things than she was. We had a great deal of difficulty deciding about the buildings. We really did. Basically, we were confronted with this. We had a minimum amount of money to do a maximum amount of things. And we had to be sure that the buildings were economically sound and that we'd done them in as good a taste as we could, considering the amount of funds we had to do it. I remember one time saying to Governor Rockefeller, I hear what you're saying, that you want outstanding, high-quality architecture. So do we. But I disagree with your saying that it doesn't cost more money. Now, George Dudley was a great advocate of high-quality architecture, and he was a strong associate of Governor Rockefeller. They've been with him for a long time in other capacities privately. And George was one whose thrust was in that direction. And I was, in a sense, on the other side of the fence, in a sense, saying, look, I appreciate high-quality, visionary architecture as well as the next fellow. But we have to pay for it. And I know it costs more money, because to make these things as beautiful and to transform into reality visionary architectural drawings cost more money than building the plain ordinary brick, etc. Now, I think there's a happy medium that can be achieved between them, but we have to opt for, and in the time period when we were talking subsequently, we had already committed ourselves to the financing of buildings through charging tuition. And I was the guy that had that responsibility. I had to sell the idea that we have tuition throughout the state university in order to use the revenues from tuition to pay the debt service on borrowings to build the buildings. Now, this didn't bother me a whit. I felt that that concept was sound. It was the way in which we were going to be spending $300 million a year instead of $30 million a year, and the way in which we were going to have control of our own destiny by taking our responsibilities out of the Department of Public Works and taking them on for ourselves, etc. And so it worked that way. But in the process, another thing got involved in the Stony Brook too, Carl, by the way. We had some difficulty with the architect. And the first architects didn't pan out as we felt that they should. We changed to a different architectural firm. Well, we didn't...
This is from whom to whom?
I've forgotten the name. I think the subsequent architects were...
DeMoss, Picorni, and Weigel come in there.
But
it's before then.
That was before then.
Maurice Walker Haynes
was a successor to the first architect.
Was it Clark and Rapuano?
Yeah. Clark and Rapuano were, I think, were involved, and there was another firm with them. I've forgotten which. Clark and Rapuano, I've forgotten whether they were the site people or the building people, but it matters not because subsequently Smith, Haynes, etc., Walker Haynes, they got brought up on charges before the American Association of Architects that they had unprofessionally cut out another architectural firm from the business with the State University. And this was a very, very serious charge because if proven and held, it could have blackballed them in the architectural field for many years to come. It was something which architects did not do. And so we had to demonstrate to the AIA that this firm did not seek out this work, that we were the ones who were dissatisfied with, and therefore, as the owners, entitled to change to a different architect at any time we wanted to do so. And that but that dispute with the architects, again, got involved in the question of how fast we moved, and it also got involved in the question of how much money got spent in the design of the building.
Did that lead to the establishment of the construction firm? Or did it come?
No, that didn't. What led to the establishment of the construction fund was Elwin Stevens and Larry Murray. Mm-hmm.
You worked pretty closely with Steve.
Yeah, Steve was my right-hand guy in the construction area. And Otto Tegan was the State University architect for whom Steve worked. But Otto was a distinguished, quiet sort of individual with a deep sense of humor. I hit him out looking at a site for the State University College in Westchester one day. We were on top of a big hill that Governor Rockefeller had suggested we look at as a possible site. And I recall when we got up there, Otto turned to me out of breath and says, "This site is for the birds." And so that was the end of that. That's the end of that site's consideration. But now I'll go back. At that time, the university was so constricted with a lot of these governmental regulations, red tape practices, that things moved at a snail's pace, particularly as it related to construction, where the State Department of Public Works was the state construction agency. The State Department of Public Works had the authority to appoint architects. Over a period of time, the university had worked out with them a plan, an agreement under which the State University trustees would suggest to DPW a panel of architects from whom the DPW would select an architectural firm. They meaning the university trustees and staff, put four or five firms on the panel each time, and usually DPW would pick one of them. Sometimes they ignored the panel, which they had a right to do, and they took somebody else of their own persuasion. Here again, Larry Murray was
free. You just weren't free.
No, we weren't free at all. And this was a very, very unsatisfactory way of doing things. Now, here again, Larry Murray. The individual who was executive assistant to the Public Works Commissioner, head of DPW, a chap named Joe Ronan, he and I were newspaper men together. And I had a meeting with Joe, and I said, Joe, come on, this is ridiculous. We can't do business this way. You're looking bad, we're looking worse, because things aren't being done, they're not happening the way they ought to happen. Finally, Joe and I worked out our own arrangement, whereby when we submitted the panel, they picked, most of the time from the panel, the firm that we felt comfortable working with. So we made some improvement in that direction, just administratively between two newspaper men who said...